From the Kennan Institute in Washington, D.C., welcome to Kennan X, a podcast on our never-ending quest to understand Russia, Ukraine, and the surrounding region. I'm your host, Jill Doherty. This episode of Kennan X already was going to be a little different. I talk about the book that I'm writing about Russia. We recorded it, got it ready for air, and then came February 16th and the death of Alexei Navalny. Nothing quite seems the same after that. So you'll hear the interview as it was recorded, but the optimism with which I've always tried to look at Russia is gone. I still believe that many Russian people want a better Russia, but Putin's Russia is moving in a very unpredictable and very dangerous direction. As faithful followers of the Kennan X podcast know, I am, well, passionately interested in Russia. I know I'm not alone. Many of my colleagues and friends have the same fascination with Russia that I do. Not to get too psychological, but it goes far beyond academic interest. It's deep and personal. A lot of it is based on my experiences in the country and on my relationships with individual Russians I know, with the rich and always challenging Russian language, and with the culture. Now, I can already hear some of my colleagues, including Russians, saying, I've gone off the deep end here, and I know that it can at times be a love-hate relationship. But I did want to let our Kennan X followers in on a secret. I've been writing a book on Russia about the years I've spent in the country, and even before, in high school, when I began studying the Russian language. My nearly decade covering Russia for CNN and taking it right up to today and Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. It's the first book that I've ever written, even though I've spent a lifetime as a journalist writing and broadcasting in various formats, but it's been a challenge. And yet, I have a publisher, I have a deadline for submitting my draft manuscript, and I have chained myself to my computer to get it done in time. It covers half a century, and believe me, I'm more amazed at that than anyone. So as I went back to my early years with Russia, I began sharing those impressions, ideas, events, emotions with people who trod similar paths, trying to understand it all. And to find, as a friend who's author of several books put it, the Krasная нить, the red thread that weaves it all together. One of those people is my guest for this episode, and he is John Byerly, former U.S. ambassador to Russia. He's a career diplomat. He also served as ambassador to Bulgaria, and he played an important role in U.S.-Russia relations in modern Russia after the end of the Soviet Union. Under President Clinton, for example, he was the director for Russia policy at the National Security Council. He's also one of the best Russian speakers I know, and he has a visceral understanding of the country. And it turns out we have a lot in common. We both were exchange students at Leningrad State University. We both were young Russian-speaking guides on U.S. Information Agency exhibits in the old Soviet Union, and we both worked at the Voice of America. John went the diplomatic route. I became a journalist. So, welcome, John.
Thanks, Jill. I'm really happy to be here.
You're laughing already. You know, the hardest part about writing my book really is to figure out where I should end it, since I'm still very much involved in Russian affairs. And the country, to be a little more serious, it seems to me, is at a crucial stage in its modern history, with Vladimir Putin leading it in a direction, well, let's say, that does not bode well for the future. But let's get back to how you got interested in Russia. Like me, you're growing up in the U.S. in the early 1950s, a child of the Cold War. So where did you start?
Well, I started, I would say, maybe in high school. I grew up in Muskegon, Michigan. a fairly small town on the shores of Lake Michigan. And I discovered in high school that I had a knack for languages. I took German, I took French. I was the kid who never had to study anything and passed all the tests. So teachers started taking me aside and saying, when you go to university, you're going to continue with this, but you should take a hard language. So when I got to university and looked around what the options were, I could take Arabic, I could take Chinese, or I could take Russian. The time that I started at university was 1972. That was the year that President Nixon and Soviet leader Brezhnev had their first meeting in Moscow, their first summit meeting, and they signed a couple of arms control agreements. That was really the start of the policy of détente, and the news media were full of it, a lot about Russia. At the same time, at the other end of the ideological spectrum, in 1973, we had the first publication of Solzhenitsyn's memoir, Gulag Archipelago, which, in addition to being acknowledged as a literary masterpiece, was also the definitive indictment of the entire Soviet system. And it raised the profile of Soviet dissidents. It brought the word refusnik into the English language. Mm-hmm. So a combination of those two things made Russia almost inescapably a fascinating place, the Soviet Union, Russia, a fascinating place for a kid 19 years old who was just sort of starting out on his path, not knowing where he wanted to go. But studying Russian seemed to make a lot of sense to me. And that's how I got started.
Yeah. And as I was just recounting what we both went through, exchange students, guides, et cetera, thinking back in my own career, there were at that point, beginning really in the 60s, you'd have to say, there were these programs by the U.S. government that prepared cadres, shall we say, people studying this critical language, which was extremely important, the U.S. being extremely frightened about what the Soviets were up to with the space race and all of that. So I actually did benefit, as I'm presuming you did, from these government programs, most of which don't really exist in the same form that they did then. But did you also have like NDFL fellowships, et cetera, to go through some of this?
When I went to Russia, the Soviet Union, for the first time in 1976, I went on a program called the Council on International Educational Exchange, CIEE, semester exchange to the Soviet Union. That was underwritten largely, as I recall, by the Ford Foundation. And if I'm not mistaken, I may be paid $250, $500 total for that semester. Mm-hmm. Living in a dormitory in the Soviet Union, all my meals, travel, everything was covered. And I paid a very nominal amount of that. And that was definitely a result of a conscious decision of the U.S. government to try to push more people into learning about Russia and the Soviet Union.
Yeah. And even my high school teacher took advantage of that. He was a native Russian speaker, but he also got, I think it was NDEA funding from the government, National Defense Education Act, I believe. Mm-hmm. So there were some really good programs. And then we were both in the same dormitory. Общежитие номер шесть. Dormitory number six in St. Petersburg, better known as Leningrad at that time. That also, for me, was an education because I'm slightly ahead of you. And we were there. I have a twin sister who also was studying Russian and was there at the time. And we both had, this is during the Vietnam War, we both had encounters sometimes with Vietnamese students. There was a lot of animosity toward Americans because of the war. And we were really exposed to geopolitical events and the Soviet Union's reaction to that.
Yeah, for me, I think it was a little bit different because you're right. You're a couple of years ahead of me. And by the time I went to Leningrad on the semester program, lived in that famous dormitory number six, there's a whole list of people that we know who live there. And it's food for a lot of interesting conversation. But when I went, we were in the middle of the policy of détente. Hmm. As I said, Nixon had already done two summits in Moscow, I think. President Ford, following him, had had his summit with Brezhnev out in Vladivostok. And the U.S. and the USSR were still ideological rivals, but I didn't feel like I had an enemy of the people sign on my back in the way that maybe you did. It was a little bit easier to talk to people. It was a little bit easier to get out and do things because you didn't feel that you were going to be put in an awkward situation. So that, I think, really colored my experience living in the dormitory. You remember we had Soviet roommates. Mm-hmm. The first time I'd ever actually lived with a Russian, and your Russian language improves by leaps and bounds. But what was fascinating about those 4 or 5 months was the contrast, because we'd all heard about the Soviet Union, Sputnik, tremendous space program, space race was on, arms control. Soviets had the possibility to destroy the world with their nuclear arsenal, just like we did. It sort of looked like this enormous monolithic thing out there on the geopolitical landscape. And yet when you got into the country, you remember, suddenly you discovered people standing in lines a half mile long to get oranges or bananas, running out of toilet paper. Mm-hmm. Very elemental things that didn't add up. If this was the great superpower that we were locked in a confrontation with, why did they have so much trouble providing the basics of life for their people? Not to mention the whole question of Soviets, Russians who wanted to leave the country and couldn't.
Yeah.
So the contradiction in that, I think, was what really drew me out of studying language and literature and culture, which I continued to do. That had been my focus in the university. When I went back after those 4 or 5 months in Leningrad, I wanted to study international relations. Mm. I wanted to take some foreign policy courses and begin to try to unravel this riddle.
Yeah.
And you can say probably you feel the same way. I've kind of been in the process of trying to unravel it my whole life.
That's really true. You know, I'm just thinking in our dormitory, there really was a difference. I think I'm probably 5 years older than you. And I was there in 69, and the war is over in 45. And it felt as if it had kind of just ended. I mean, yeah. We would run out of hot water. We had to go to the banya. And I remember it was a rollicking good time because Russian banya is its own institution, public baths and steam and all of this. But I remember seeing these women in the banya, and they would always say, "Oh, you girls are too skinny." And they were all very, you know, pretty overweight.
Yeah.
But then I realized that just a few years before, from like, what is it, 41 to 43, probably these women were going through the blockade of Leningrad, the Nazi blockade mm-hmm. of Leningrad, in which people starved to death.
Yeah.
So the reality of that, I stopped laughing. And I think to this day, even though I abhor a lot of what President Putin is doing, I do think understanding that he grew up in that same environment. He was born in 52, and he was growing up, oddly enough, just a few miles from where our dormitory was located, on the kind of mean streets, the back streets of Leningrad, which was kind of a tough place. In addition to the tourist sites, it can be a very tough town. And he's growing up. And I think that chip on his shoulder, and also the things that his family went through during the war, father shot up at the front, his mother almost dies, freezes and starves to death, if you can believe it. But I do believe, from that one book that was written about him by the journalist early on when he was running for president, and then also his, what would have been his older brother, mm-hmm. who dies in the blockade and is buried in a common grave. So all of these things helped me to understand later, as I was trying to report on Putin, a little bit more what perhaps is going on in his mind.
Yeah, all of that, I think, certainly is an explanation for why he is who he is, why he has done the things that he's done. But it's certainly no excuse for mm-hmm. it. There were plenty of other people who went through that same crucible of the Siege of Leningrad who didn't launch an unprovoked war on their neighbor, right, which continues to this day. But Putin in Leningrad, again, I was about 5 years after you, and I was at Leningrad State University taking courses that semester, mm-hmm, about the same time that Putin was there as a university student.
Mm-hmm. He graduated in 75, yeah.
Right. And, you know, I've met him a few times over the years. And at one point, I was telling him about my time in Leningrad, and we determined that maybe we had eaten at the same cafeteria at the same time. All of that was very interesting. And it really just underscored what a different experience being in Leningrad in 1976 was, especially for a kid from provincial Michigan who had really not been out and seen much of the world. I had a roommate in my dormitory in Leningrad who worked at the Kirov Theater, which was the main stage for opera and ballet. He was a backstage hand, and he used to sneak us in through the backstage door to watch some of the performances from the wings. This is the Kirov. This is like getting into the Met in American terms. And the only condition was we weren't supposed to say anything. We had to dress like we were Soviets. And if anyone challenged us, we were supposed to say we were from the Baltic states. We were Estonians. And that would explain our strange accents.
Yeah. And then actually, I think an important point here is it was lived experiences we had that taught us more about the Soviet Union at that point than any book. You could see, like, why were they running out of hot water in the dorm? Well, mm-hmm, energy problems, etc. Picking it up, going now to USIA exhibits. Oh, sure. Yeah, jump in.
You made me think of one anecdote there. Yeah. So one night I'm out walking with my roommate in Leningrad, very dark, and we pass a building and there's some sort of statuary on top of the building. And I look up and I said, is that Lenin? Is that a statue of Lenin on top of that building? And my roommate said, oh, we would never put Lenin on top of a building like that. What if he fell? Avdruk upadet. And my eyes just got wide because this is the same guy who would harangue us in the dormitory for the microphones about the virtues of the Soviet system. So that was an incredible eye-opener for me.
Yes, and I'm sure you had friends. I mean, I made friends, and I saw what was really the reality for me of the Soviet Union, which was kitchen conversations. Mm-hmm. They were living in one room, as many people in Leningrad at that time were living in. They lived in a communal apartment, which was chopped up into essentially one room for one family with a common kitchen, common toilet, no shower. That's why they went to the banya.
A lot of those in Leningrad.
Absolutely. It was a problem in post-war because they were not able to build housing enough as they needed. But he was married, and their inner life, which was lived in that room, everything they did was in that room. And it was the only safe space that they could talk about anything. And it's still, to this day, I've had that experience recently when the invasion of Ukraine, Putin's invasion in February 2022 happened. I was talking with a friend, and here we are decades later, half a century later, and we both said to each other this phrase, which I'm sure you remember, «Это не телефонный разговор».
Yes.
You know, this is not a telephone conversation. And what that means is we're being bugged, listened to. We can't talk on the phone. I'll tell you in person later. We won't even talk about it. That's what life was like. So you're right. I felt schizophrenic, I think is the word, that, as you said, the great Soviet Union, powerful nuclear weapons, space race, and no toilet paper. So it was very disorienting, but very eye-opening experience.
Yeah. I had something the same experience just a few years ago. I think it was 2016, 2017 was my last trip to Russia. And I found when I talked to people, by then Russia had annexed Crimea, and I would try to argue with people about that. And I found that they were lowering their voices when they said something that didn't really accord with what the official line was, in the same way that people used to lower their voices in the Soviet period when they knew the walls had ears. And I thought, oh boy, we're back. Plus ça change. The more things change, they're the same.
And just to quickly touch on those U.S. Information Agency exhibits, I know the Soviets had some exhibits, but it wasn't at all as robust as our program. But what would you say? There were so many of them, and I would really urge the people who are listening to look up some of the history. It is fascinating. So these exhibits, John and I and other people were on working as guides, they would go for months. You would usually set up in one city, and they were all over the Soviet Union, set up in one city, be open for a month. You would have incredible numbers of visitors. In fact, the exhibit, I was on two exhibits. The first one was Research and Development USA in 1972. And at the end of that year, it had 2 million people who had visited that exhibit in person. Mm-hmm. So it was obviously, you know, soft power propaganda, but it was also the fascination of Soviet people who had never, ever dreamed that they would see an American and could come up to the stand. And yes, they might ask about the scientific experiment that's taking place on the stand, but really they wanted to know, where do you live? What kind of an apartment do you live in? And we'd say, well, actually in a house, et cetera. These reality checks on what they were hearing in the media about big, bad capitalist America. And then the reality of American students. I'll give one example, which is kind of crazy, but I remember this one guy saying, so the government basically fixes your teeth, right? I mean, you all have really nice teeth. So the government pays for that, right? Because you're guides and they want to show that America is superior. And I said, well, actually, no, I wish they had, but they don't. But it was an interesting time where they were turned off to a lot of what their own government was saying. What would you say, John? You were on two exhibits and obviously saw many other things about this. What would you say was the effect or the importance of those exhibits at that time?
Well, you said that they were soft power propaganda, and they were certainly that. But I would say they were also counter propaganda, because as you said, the view of the United States and the West that was presented to the average Soviet citizen was a place that you Soviets wouldn't want to live. We have it better in the Soviet Union. And the purpose of the exhibit was to give them an alternative view of something that was happening that they otherwise wouldn't have. It used to amaze me, frankly, that they sent these exhibits to these provincial cities. One thing in Moscow and Leningrad to have people come, they're worldly, and some of them even traveled abroad. As you said, in some of these towns, Selenograd, Dushanbe, this is the first time anyone had ever talked to an American. And it was as much that experience of talking to us as people and figuring out that, hey, we didn't have horns growing out of our head. That was as effective in its way as any of the hardware we demonstrated. I used to demonstrate Polaroid cameras, the photography exhibit, the old SX-70 where the picture would zip out the bottom. I mean, it was even magical for us, for Americans. For the Soviets, it was something else. But as you know, when we started to talk about that, really I would answer the questions, how does this work? What does it cost? And then the other questions would start. How much does a pound of meat cost? What does your father do for a living? Who killed President Kennedy? Mm. All of these questions that they wanted to ask just sort of came flowing out. And for me, one episode really captures the power that we were projecting, soft power that we were projecting. One of my colleagues on the exhibit, a woman from California, was very sort of liberal, progressive, and very anti-Vietnam War. The war had ended by that time, but we still talked a lot about it because the Soviets wanted to harangue us about having done it. And she would harangue the United States too. She would dump on the Nixon administration, Johnson for getting us in the war, and huge crowds would gather around her as she did this. And then you were on the stand for an hour or so, you'd break away, go away, and the exhibit would close. And the next day, some of the same people came back to talk to her again. And she said to one of the guys, weren't you here yesterday when I was saying the same stuff? And he said, yeah, you say these amazing things, and we come back the next day and you're still there. We thought they would have gotten rid of you after what we heard from you yesterday. Think about that for a minute.
Wow.
Yeah.
just maybe to bring it up to today, because, you know, as I think about, I teach at Georgetown, and I'm looking at my students and thinking about students in Russia who are being now prevented from going outside of the country to go on exchange programs. Putin wants them all home, either to study or perhaps to go and fight in the war in Ukraine. And it's kind of a sad commentary to me, and this is my personal opinion, but I do believe that he is taking them back to something like that period that you and I experienced, which is a more closed off period, a feeling of, certainly they're surrounded by propaganda now. It is just, you know, the entire media world has been shut down, and most journalists, anyone in the opposition has fled. And also this kind of sense of superiority, inferiority. And I begin to wonder how young people actually feel whether they are connected to the outside world anymore, the way that soon after in the 70s, the end of the 70s, and then you get into the 80s and you have Gorbachev opening it up. Maybe that period of Gorbachev and the opening and all of that really was an exception. Sadly. I know you know what I'm talking about, but it feels like that bright moment where there was some promise and opening, and now it feels very dark.
Yeah, you know, I remember when soon after the Soviet Union fell apart, that's when I was working at the Clinton White House doing Russia stuff. I went to Moscow on, it was actually a summit meeting, Clinton summit meeting, and I was at a reception talking to someone who had been very high up in the KGB. And we were talking about the fact that the Soviet Union had fell apart, what the consequences of that, why it happened. And he said a phrase that I've never forgotten. He said, that whole Soviet communist experience for us here was like a long detour down a dead end road. And he said, now we're trying to come back from that dead end, and it'll take us a while, but maybe, you know, we'll make it back to the crossroads. Well, what Putin is doing right now is exactly the same. He's taking that country on a long detour, which can only stop at a dead end, because he's not building that country into anything more than a vassal of China, frankly. This is another long conversation. But my experience of meeting many, many Russians, even Soviets, who didn't agree with this, whose values were aligned more toward what we would call Western values or international values, those people are, I think, still a majority in Russia. Many of them are quiet now, in the same way they had to be during the Soviet period. But knowing that about Russia, you said viscerally, I understand. Well, I wish I understood a lot about Russia, but I know that there are so many people there who want nothing more than for Russia to be another normal country. And I think strategically in the long run, history is on their side, not on Putin's side.
Well, we can hope, because I think a lot of us who've spent time there and have a lot of, I would call it affection, respect and affection for the country and its people, would like it to be a normal country too, just a normal country, instead of what it is now, which feels like an exception to almost every rule. But I guess maybe we end it here. I have to, as I said, I chained myself to my book. So now I have to go back.
back to work, Jill.
I know. And yeah, as I said, I'm not quite sure where it all ends, but I presume as I finish it up, there will be an ending and some type of Krasnaya Nit that will pull it all together and I will understand what it all means. I don't know. We'll see. But Ambassador, yeah, do you have any last-minute thoughts on this?
I can't wait to read the book because, as I said, I'm on this lifelong quest to try to figure out what the hell is actually happening in that country that matters so much, that's so globally consequential. And, you know, every new integer of information helps. So back to work, Doherty.
All right. All right. Well, thank you very much, Ambassador John Byerly. It was really a pleasure. And as usual, I learned something from you. And it's great to have you as a colleague and friend.
Likewise. Thanks a lot, Jill.
Kenan X is a product of the Kenan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. It's the Wilson Center's oldest program, founded in 1974 by George F. Kennan, American statesman, James Billington, historian and former Librarian of Congress, and historian S. Frederick Starr. Inspired by them, the Kennan Institute's mission is to improve America's understanding of Russia and the wider region. Thanks for listening.